We're one member short of a quorum, so we'll wait with the minutes, and but we'd like to proceed with our testimony today in the interest of time. So we'd begin by welcoming President Kaler here this morning. And now we do have a quorum, so I'm going to officially call the meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. And maybe quickly we can just have somebody move the minutes. Representative Banyan?
Yeah.
Quick study?
So quick, yes.
Okay.
Move the minutes.
Representative Banyan has made a motion to approve the minutes. Any questions? Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And the minutes are approved. Okay, now we can begin. President Kaler, again, welcome to the committee. We look forward to a nice discussion here for the next hour and a half or so.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Good afternoon. I'm very pleased to be with you today and do hope that we have a conversation about the vision and future of the University of Minnesota. I am accompanied here today by Linda Cohen, the chair of our Board of Regents, and her colleagues, Regent Rick Beeson and Regent Maureen Ramirez, who are there. I'd also like to introduce to the committee our new Vice President for Academic Affairs and Provost of the University, Karen Hansen. Provost Hansen recently came to us from her position as Provost at Indiana University. Like me, she is a graduate of the university, undergraduate degrees in mathematics and philosophy. She was not fortunate enough to attend the University of Minnesota as a graduate student as I was. She instead had to go to Harvard. Where she did well and went on to a full career at Indiana University and now is back here. I am thankful for this opportunity to share with you my vision for the university. I am passionate about public higher education and how it can transform the lives of students, the economy, and the culture of this great state. I first came to the university in September of 1978. I was about to be 22 years old, and I was about to be a graduate student in the best chemical engineering program in the country. I had a fellowship, financial aid, which was the only reason I was able to come to the university as the son of a blue-collar family. That was my first encounter with the excellence of this university and the access that was provided to me. When I began graduate school, I was convinced that my career goal should be the youngest vice president of a Fortune 500 company. But in my third year, I was asked to teach a class. And that experience transformed me. I love the classroom, the students, the research. I love public higher education and the mission of our land-grant universities, of which we are one, and a commitment to teaching, to research, and to engagement. I love the university then, and I love it now. But I do believe its two essential pillars of excellence and access are at risk. And they are at risk because of a continued decline in our state's ability to support the university, its only research university. We are and we want to continue to be excellent and world-class, accessible to qualified students from all economic backgrounds, a leader in science, technology, engineering, and math education in the state, nation, and the world, a center for medicine and the health sciences, a place where the liberal arts are valued, a vibrant academic and diverse cultural community that changes lives, catapults people with a passion to successful careers and to become leaders, and importantly, an important engine, a critical engine for job creation in the state of Minnesota. Let me turn to begin with to our state's ability to support its university. As state funding has declined, and we all understand why it has declined, we have had to raise tuition to cover some of that shortfall and to maintain the excellence required to prepare our students to be successful in a highly competitive global jobs marketplace. If you would like to hear them, I can detail the many consequences of this loss in state funding. We have managed, but the status quo is far from stable. This rise in tuition has come as university leaders have bathed this $3.7 billion organization with about 25,000 employees, much more efficient. When I was a student here 35 years ago, not only was my hair longer, but the legislators and governor's support for the university was stronger. The state then supported about 43% of the university's operating budget. Today, state support is approximately 18%. Even though our graduation rates are drastically improving, and we have been faced with an increase of the same cost drivers as any large business, healthcare costs, the burden for caring for a stock of very old buildings, the energy costs for those buildings, a proliferation of technology in all its forms, and importantly, increased financial aid for students. We must maintain our excellence and our access and ensure that students go on to complete their degrees. We must make the university more affordable, and we must reduce our students' debt. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, think together with me for a minute about Minnesota's most pressing challenges today. First, there is the educational achievement gap in our K through 12 system and the changing face of our state as we become increasingly diverse. There is a decline in our manufacturing base, and there is a need to create a thoughtful, well-prepared workforce to lead this state. There is a struggle to control health care costs as our population ages and as we battle epidemics like diabetes and heart disease. And then I ask you, what are the opportunities in this state? What, with our abundance of Fortune 500 companies and a proud history of tackling tough problems, what opportunities do we have to address these challenges? And I believe the University of Minnesota is the major answer for the state. We stand at the intersection of challenge and opportunity. We stand ready, willing, and able to use our resources and talent to partner with you and other key stakeholders to develop real, meaningful, and lasting solutions to keep this state great. Let me outline my priorities, my commitments as president to achieve excellence and access and to drive economic impact. I want to reinvigorate the university's teaching and learning, our undergraduate experience, our rigorous graduate environment, and our world-class research enterprise. I want to reimagine our internal operations and functions to contain costs, reduce red tape, be more entrepreneurial, and see our university, as I like to say, pick up its pace. I want to champion to the people of the state the economic value of the research we perform, the degrees we grant, the employees we produce for 21st century jobs. I want to strengthen our business, philanthropic, and community partnerships to work together to strategically address our state needs. I want to unleash our entrepreneurial spirit, reaching globally even as we serve and engage our local communities. In this regard, I'll be speaking in a few minutes about our pioneering technology transfer and intellectual property program. I also want to lead our campuses and state to understand that access and diversity are critical to achieving excellence and maintaining Minnesota's robust economy. Mr. Chairman, before I continue to outline my vision for the university, it's critical that you know where the university stands today and its wide and deep impact and value. The health and prosperity of the University of Minnesota is directly linked to the health and prosperity of our state, but it is also linked to the prosperity of your legislative districts. For instance, Mr. Chairman, I am pleased that 176 students from your district now attend one of our five campuses, and that 892 U alumni live in House District 10A. Those alumni have earned a total of 1,116 University of Minnesota degrees, including advanced degrees in areas such as medicine, law, and engineering. In your district, the university has one of its six regional area health education centers. Plus, we have seven medical, nursing, and pharmacy affiliation agreements in your district. To all of you on this committee combined, your 15 house districts have more than 4,400 students attending one of our campuses. Your districts include about 900 university employees and nearly 23,000 alumni who together have earned more than 29,000 degrees. Those jobs and those degrees have led to enhanced lives, enhanced salaries, and increased tax dollars for our state. And in your districts, you have numerous healthcare affiliation agreements, extension offices, and labs and research centers. We supply to your districts and our state all of the pharmacists, dentists, and veterinarians who graduate in Minnesota. 85% of all those people who earn MD degrees are U-grads, and more than half of the healthcare professionals get their degrees from the University of Minnesota. Excuse me. We also have researchers, as an aside, working on cures for the common cold, and they have not succeeded, I must admit. Excuse me. As one example of combining the elements of economic development, community engagement, healthcare delivery, statewide impact, and diversity, the University of Minnesota graduates the second largest number of American Indian physicians in the United States, a great number of who begin their education at our medical school campus in Duluth. Plus, our Twin Cities Medical School campus sends medical residents across the state. And indeed, our footprint is statewide. Let me turn now to the power of our distinct and unique role as the state's only public research university, driving discoveries, cures, new products, and scientific breakthroughs. Our faculty and researchers have won grants of more than $1.5 billion over the past 2 years to cure and to discover. Those grants were awarded in a highly competitive nationwide grant market against thousands of other scientists and scholars. We are ranked 8th in the nation among all public research universities in external funding from agencies like the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. 8th in the nation from a state that is the 21st most populous state in the nation. So, Representative Detmer, I believe we wrestle above our weight when it comes to competing for those grant dollars. I hope you saw the terrific article in Sunday's Star Tribune about Professor Karen Ash, who's leading the world in seeking a cause and cure for Alzheimer's disease. And in case you didn't, we have, for your convenience, given you a copy of that article in your packet. That is a terrific example of what a public research university is, and this is what we, and we alone in Minnesota, do. Certainly, we are proud of past accomplishments by our faculty and researchers. The University of Minnesota was there when taconite was developed, pacemakers were invented, and anti-AIDS drugs were created. But in this world of what have you done for me lately, and in an environment of scarce resources, it's important for me to show you what your return on investment is right now. And so let me take just a few minutes to highlight what we are currently working on at the university. At our Academic Health Center, in addition to Alzheimer's research, our faculty, students, and researchers are on the verge of major breakthroughs in the treatment of cancer, diabetes, and childhood illnesses, cures, and treatments. Using the resources you gave us, leveraged with large amounts of private funding and federal dollars, we are aimed squarely at the most urgent problem facing this state and our nation, and that is spiraling health costs. I believe the answer is not rationing care or cutting back. The answer, the only long-term sustainable answer, are cures, treatments, and preventions like we are working on at the University of Minnesota right now. Only those cures, only those treatments, only those preventions will control the largest growing portion of your budget in the state of Minnesota. In our College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resources Sciences, we are an international leader in studying and combating the global challenge of UG99 wheat rust, which could affect the world's food supply in a very dramatic way. Our School of Public Health in the Twin Cities and our National Resources Research Institute on the Duluth campus are partnering to study the high levels of lung disease among taconite industry workers on the Iron Range. In our Carlson School of Management, where 97% of our MBA graduates get jobs soon after graduation, which is the highest rate of any business school in the nation, researchers are studying how and why our relatively small state has developed, attracted, and maintained more Fortune 500 companies than states twice our size. At our College of Education and Human Development, researchers are working with more than 300 Minnesota National Guard families, aiding in parenting resources and studying the lingering effects of parents' military deployment. In our College of Science and Engineering, a research team has developed a brain-to-computer process that is breaking new ground in allowing people with spinal cord injuries to control external motions. Our School of Nursing is a national trailblazer in developing standards in the burgeoning field of electronic health records. Undergraduates in the College of Biological Sciences are studying and mapping the DNA of life on the Mississippi River, a project that will have an impact for all of us who live near and use the nation's great river for commerce. And believe me, I could go on and on. That is a tiny fraction of a percent of the stories I could tell. But those are examples of what a public research university does, and we are the state's only one. Those projects and hundreds, if not thousands, of others allow for unique teaching and learning opportunities. They allow us to engage with different kinds of communities, urban and rural, across the state and the globe. They strengthen our partnerships with the business community, and with these projects, the entrepreneurial spirit of our faculty, staff, and students is unleashed. Now, of course, not everything we do is quantifiable. Not everything employers desire is taught in a lab or is listed on a spreadsheet. We are the state's higher education leader in the liberal arts, too. Our College of Liberal Arts is the largest on our Twin Cities campus, and our Morris campus is nationally known for its excellence in the liberal arts. Our overarching responsibility is to educate students for life. We teach and produce leaders who write and communicate clearly, work well in teams, understand the value of the arts, and whose curiosity and creativity help solve our most vexing problems in their communities and at their jobs. These students are critical not only to creating the workforce for today, but for tomorrow and for the day after. I am always delighted to recount the story of the winner of the 2011 Minnesota Cup Entrepreneur of the Year. She's a marketing expert. She's a graduate of our College of Liberal Arts. And much to Garrison Keeler's joy, she was an English major. The university must be open for discovery and for business, but our most important business is taking our state's most ambitious and creative young people and allowing them to discover on their own. As the state's only public research university, we provide special opportunities for a student like Sam Schreiner, a senior from Lino Lakes. First, he is an enthusiastic tuba player in our great Pride of Minnesota marching band. Second, in the physics classroom and lab, he evaluates satellite data. He has studied abroad in China, and he has been named a prestigious astronaut scholar by a jury of former astronauts. So indeed, Sam's mother and I can claim her son is a rocket scientist. But here's what I really want you to know. During his time at the U, Sam has received no fewer than 9 scholarships, 7 for engineering and 2 for the marching band, all because of the philanthropy that aids our students who have seen their tuition rise dramatically over the past decade. Right now, 3/4 of our students receive some kind of financial aid. And like Sam, 14,000 of our students rely on some private philanthropy for that aid. Excuse me again. I'm told colds are common in Minnesota. Sam represents the power of our science and technology education, the range of a liberal arts education that promotes his love of music, a global perspective, the access provided by financial aid, and the excellence in all he does and all that we offer him. But what does an innovative, teaching, groundbreaking research, and active community engagement mean for the state's economy and for jobs? Let me tell you. We generate $8.6 billion a year in statewide economic impact and support 70,000 jobs statewide, much of that due to our research enterprise. For every dollar the state invests, we drive a return of $13.20 to the economy of Minnesota. 13-1 return on investment. More than two-thirds of our students are Minnesotans who become top-notch employees of the future. And those students who come from elsewhere often stay in Minnesota developing businesses of their own. And in fact, a 2006 survey by our Alumni Association found that university alumni have started nearly 10,000 companies in Minnesota, some in the districts you represent. Of those company founders, 2,300 of them had first moved here to attend the university. Almost more than any other institution in the state, we are a talent magnet, bringing human capital to our state as the world's business is increasingly international. We generate patents and transfer our technology into the marketplace, creating much-needed and high-wage jobs. We have almost 500,000 alumni around the world, spreading the University of Minnesota's brand and elevating the reputation of this state. So I have told you my story. I have detailed the power and range of Minnesota's only public research university and showed you the values and jobs we bring to the state. So now let me turn to the future and tell you where I think we are headed. First, teaching and learning. We are responding to the demand from students and parents and from employers as we increase enrollment in key departments and colleges. Over the next 3 years, we will add 1,000 undergraduate slots in the so-called STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, as well as nursing. In my vision, we will step up our game in those academic areas. There is great opportunity. This nation and state are falling behind the rest of the world in producing world-class scientists. Last year, and these are depressing statistics, 32% of American students scored proficient in a worldwide standardized science test, 32%. In Minnesota, of course, we are a bit better, but not much. Only 48% of our students in fifth grade, eighth grade, and high school were proficient in science. Less than half. We at the University of Minnesota can be and should be leaders in producing first-rate scientists for our state and nation. And we can be and should be leaders in the most rigorous and thoughtful uses of distance learning. Our Crookston campus, for example, is already considered a national leader, and I would like to see us expand and fine-tune our e-learning opportunities. We must promote interdisciplinary opportunities in the classroom and the laboratory. That's why our biomedical discovery district on our Twin Cities campus is so important, and why I'm so grateful that this legislature has been a helpful and critical partner with us in funding that exciting complex. That discovery district is a true crossroads where scientists and social scientists, physicians and veterinarians meet, teach, and discover. Our new physics and nanotechnology building, which the legislature also helped fund, will be a center for interdisciplinary work too, some of it leading, we hope, to major innovations in manufacturing processes. That leads me to the university's commitment to operational excellence and our stepped-up entrepreneurial spirit. Let me tell you about our new first-in-the-nation Minnesota Innovations Partnership Initiative, or MIN-IP. MIN-IP will more easily move the discoveries and intellectual property of our scientists and engineers and all of our faculty into the marketplace. In the years past, there was often much negotiating between the university and private industry over intellectual property. Those negotiations often ended with us owning 100% of nothing as our industry partners walked away in frustration. With MIN-IP, that process will be speeded up tremendously without negatively affecting the university's ability to profit from any major discoveries our faculty and researchers develop. The main point? I want this university to move from a default mode of nope, can't do it, never done it that way, to one of yes, let's take a risk, let's give it a try, and let's succeed together. Meanwhile, I recently charged all of the senior leaders in the university to conduct what we call a risk recalibration examination to eliminate or rethink all kinds of unnecessary and redundant policies and procedures. So just as you here at the legislature are seeking to redesign how you do your business, we are pushing all of our hundreds of separate academic and business units to reduce paperwork, pay vendors electronically, and centralize account activity. first steps, baby steps, and they may sound elementary, but for the U, it's new, and it could save us millions of dollars. And of course, we must better align the University of Minnesota with the MinSCU system. The U and MinSCU's missions are different, but we share a commitment to quality and service and to educating a workforce. Together, we must reduce our operating costs, perhaps through joint purchasing or shared service. But you should know, the University and MinSCU have over 200 programs working now for the students of Minnesota. Let me turn to our important community and business partnerships. In many ways, the mission and the reason for being of our university campus in Rochester is to be a part of one of the nation's most vibrant health sciences communities. Our partnership with the Mayo Clinic in all we do in teaching and learning in Rochester is groundbreaking, and I want to see that grow. Our partnership with Mayo on cancer research and now with our Decade of Discovery initiative to cure diabetes enhances our brand as a world leader in medical breakthroughs. Meanwhile, in northeastern Minnesota, we are engaged in the critical and pressing issue of the future of the state's mining and iron ore industry. This is an industry that this university has long supported and helped invent with its science and its resources. Right now, as the industry revives itself, there are real environmental concerns being expressed by state and federal government agencies and Native American tribes. Our scientists, both on our Twin Cities and Duluth campuses, are working hard to produce reliable scientific data to guide policy. The university is committed to lend our resources to find innovative ways through technology and discovery to help, as best we can, resolve the issues facing the state's mining industry. Now, sometimes that scientific work doesn't occur as quickly as we would like, but we're committed to move that aggressively forward. And that's one of my visions, that as the state's only public research university, we become and remain a key player and convener in tackling the state's most pressing problems. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, before I close, I must emphasize this. We are at a pivotal point, perhaps a tipping point. The state has been disinvesting in this university and higher education in recent years. And there is a direct correlation between state support for this university and the rise in tuition. As state support declines, tuition increases. And that reality has occurred even as this university has become markedly more efficient in teaching our undergraduates. This is important. Over the past decade, we have seen a decline in the per capita revenue from state funds and tuition we receive to educate a student. Adjusted for inflation, that decline is about 12% per student. So we are more efficient in teaching and graduating the state's best students, than we have ever been, despite a decrease in state funding and support. But Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would like to remind you of what I think is our shared responsibilities. We are partners to make higher education in Minnesota the best it can be and to ensure student success and access. Looking into the future and understanding my vision, I want to make you this offer. If you will re-engage with the University of Minnesota, I will pledge to minimize tuition increases so that we, together, can move this great institution forward to drive the economy of this state. We must be strong to fulfill our vision of a university that is excellent, that is accessible to qualified students of all economic backgrounds, that is bold, risk-taking, and committed to operational excellence and efficiency, creative in its teaching of undergraduates, and that is attractive to graduate students from around the world who are driven to discover, that is infused with a sense of civic responsibility, filled with curiosity, and that understands that diversity is critical to achieving excellence in the classroom and on the job. This vision of the University of Minnesota may be mine today, but it is not about me. It is about our 69,000 students in Crookston, Duluth, Morris, Rochester, and the Twin Cities, about our faculty who are training and inspiring them, and about our researchers who are poised to change the world. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I realize some of you might not believe, as I do, in the power of the liberal arts. And while I can show you all that we do, some of you might think we've turned our back on agriculture. And maybe some others believe that, despite all the engineers we train, the university can't reinvigorate the state's manufacturing economy. but on this fact, I respectfully submit there can be no dispute. For every dollar you and the governor invest in the University of Minnesota, we return $13.20 to the state's economy. Some of you have asked for a detailed statement of the damage caused by the reduction of our state allocation by $140 million over the past 3 years. And we have pages of details, open faculty positions, larger class sizes, layoff of staff, and many other consequences for students and their families and our employees and their families. And I can share that detail with you if you would like. But in the end, a $140 million cut translates into an annual negative impact on the state's economy of more than $1.8 billion every year. That's $1.8 billion of lost economic activity, lost jobs every year. The University of Minnesota is a machine that multiplies every one of the state's investment dollars 13 times over. That number attests to the great investment we are and the profound value that I believe we bring to the state and to your districts. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for listening to my vision. I would be happy to entertain questions if you would like, Mr. Chair, at this time, but I would also like to introduce two other speakers for the remainder of the session. So at your discretion, we could do that now or I could take questions now.
Thank you, President Kaler. We'll see if there are questions at this time. If not, you can hold your questions till later if you'd like. I think we'll proceed.
Okay, yeah. Great. I would like to introduce to you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, two people. First, chemistry professor Chris Kramer, the chair of our faculty consultative committee, the university's highest ranking faculty governance group. Dr. Kramer, however, will be trumped because he will be followed by someone even more highly ranked, Ms. Katie Myron, a student who was the 2010 Princess K of the Milky Way. Thank you again, Professor Kramer. Katie, you're going to go first. Okay. Actually, Katie is going to go first. I'm sorry. You really do. I will yield.
Ran out of chairs. Okay. Okay. So you can decide who's first, and then
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, we did age before beauty for your colleagues in the other body yesterday, so we thought we'd mix it up today.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Katie Miron, and I'm a junior majoring in agricultural education at the University of Minnesota, and I am a horrible decision maker. I agonize over every single detail, weighing the pros and cons, asking for advice, and thoroughly thinking things through before I make my final choice. My senior year of high school, I was faced with many choices, and one that caused me many sleepless nights was deciding to run to become a Minnesota FFA state officer. Two of my siblings had served as state officers, and while I always looked up to them, wanting to be as much like them as possible, no younger sibling can stand being compared to their siblings all the time. I went back and forth, not able to determine if what I would gain from the experience was worth the risk that I wouldn't measure up. And then I realized something. I was looking at the situation all wrong. While, as many people can tell you, there are similarities between my siblings and I, we are very different. I didn't have to worry so much, and I definitely couldn't let that feeling of insecurity prevent me from doing something that I wanted, something that I knew was right for me. Serving as the 2009-2010 Minnesota FFA State Vice President was a worthwhile experience that I never lamented. And just like I never regretted that decision, I never have once regretted my decision to attend the University of Minnesota. Even though my older siblings also attended the university and obtained degrees in the major I'm now pursuing. Even when, as a freshman, I realized that I had no idea what college was going to be like. I'd watch my siblings go off to school so I thought I knew all about college life. I knew how to ride the connector, how to use my U-card to eat in the dining hall, and where all of my classes were. But I quickly realized that college is totally different. I was completely responsible for myself. My mom wasn't there to wake me up in the morning or to make sure that I did my homework. I miss being surrounded by people who loved me and looked out for me. And then, just when things seemed overwhelming, I realized I didn't have to do it all alone. I had people who supported me, and one of those people was my sister, Anne. As a senior at the university, she knew exactly what I was feeling, and she helped me to stop worrying. Through all of this, there was one thing that I never had to concern myself with, and that was tuition. As a dairy farmer's daughter with five siblings, my parents did what they could, but thanks to scholarships, I was able to focus on gaining the most from my college experience. I'm proud to say that I'm a student at the University of Minnesota, which means when I graduate, my diploma will be more than just a piece of paper. It will allow me to reach my goal of becoming an agricultural education teacher, and it means that I'm prepared to give my students a quality education. Life is full of decisions, but I can't say that the university would have even been an option had tuition costs been higher. It may have just been an unobtainable dream. You can make the decision to support the future of Minnesota, to give a land-grant university, older than the state itself, a chance to provide its students with a quality education. As I move on in my life, I plan to remain engaged with the university, encouraging student success. I hope that your commitment to the university remains as strong as it has in the past. As you witness the success of our graduates across the state of Minnesota and what they bring to the vitality of our economy, I know that your decision to continue to support the university will be a decision that you can take maroon and gold pride in. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing me to speak with you today, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I don't know, did you say where you're from? Where did you?
I grew up on a dairy farm in Hugo, Minnesota, Hugo. So just okay. North of here, and I actually went to Forest Lake High School. So.
Okay. Yay! I have a question.
And how was that? Oh. And I know others may have questions, but we hear a lot about remedial. I'm guessing you went from Forest Lake High School to college without any remedial necessary?
Correct. Yeah. I actually came into the university with 14 college credits already under my belt, and so I came into the university knowing what I wanted to do and pretty prepared for what I was faced with, but obviously it is important to prepare our high school students for the rigorous coursework that they will face at the University of Minnesota.
Great to hear that. Representative Detmer.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. And Katie, again, welcome to our committee here. And you're going to be a teacher, right?
Correct.
Okay. Now, if Forest Lake were to offer you a job, now, you didn't tell everybody that your older brother and sister, Mike and Ann, also are ag teachers at Forest Lake High School. Would you accept the job with your brothers and sisters in the same department?
Would I accept a job?
Only if it's yours.
You know what? Actually, I think growing up on a dairy farm, you learn how to work with all kinds of people, and that's a skill that workers and employers are really looking for in the workplace. So I know exactly where I fit into my family and how we all work together. So accepting a job would, I'd be pleased to accept a job and to stay close to home.
Well, that would be great. Thank you.
Very good. Anyone else have a question or comment? Well, thank you very much. And we'll move on here to Chris Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. So you heard a wonderful big picture story from the president and a wonderful personal story from Katie. I'd like to tell you a story as well that's about a student, but from a faculty perspective, my perspective. And in particular, a recent student of mine whose life was changed by the U, and in particular changed by the unique combination of teaching and research that's part of the university's mission. And so to respect her privacy, I'll just call her Amanda. She was one of about 90 students in an undergraduate quantum mechanics course I taught a few years ago, and quantum mechanics is a hard course. I actually asked to have a few slides about the quantum mechanical angular momentum operator put in your packets, and Jason Roloff, he vetoed that. I don't really understand that. But in any case, that difficulty caused Amanda to struggle. But I came to know her increasingly well throughout the course because she put in lots of effort. She attended every lecture. She came to help sessions. She came to office hours. She worked hard. And so through occasional conversations with her, I came to learn she was working nights to help put herself through the U. She often looked tired and stressed. And so when the semester finally came to an end, I was delighted. I was able to award her a passing grade in the honorable lower half of the class that met all the course expectations. So I was flattered, but I was a bit apprehensive when Amanda came to my office the next semester to inquire about doing research with my research group. I was flattered that she'd enjoyed my class enough to come talk to me, and I was a little apprehensive she might find the challenges of the research endeavor even greater than those that she'd experienced in the classroom. But I consider it part of my job. It's an obligation that if a student comes to me and wants to be instructed, I ought to be willing to take on that instruction, and so I took her on, and she joined my group of graduate students and postdoctoral associates and other undergraduates as well. So let me be clear that there's an enormous difference between sort of the research education and the coursework education at the U. I asked Amanda to take on a project we had no clue would work. That's what research is. It's trying out brand new ideas in order to generate new knowledge, what's going to form the basis for the textbooks that are used to teach the next generation. And that pushing back the frontier, that's research. That's the important part. And in particular, I asked Amanda to try to develop a model that would predict how quickly drug molecules cross cell membranes. That matters for pharmaceutical efficacy. It's not an easy problem. I didn't choose it because other people in my group were working on it and Amanda could nibble at little parts of it. It was hers, succeed or fail on as she would. And like any undergrad, Amanda needed a lot of advice and guidance at the outset, but it took very little time for me to notice she was driven by the intellectual challenge of the research endeavor. Once she understood how to use the tools of my group's trade, she threw herself into her work. She was still taking coursework. Nevertheless, she spent hours every week in the lab generating data, thinking about her results, driving the project along in a very productive way. And she became an inspiration for other members of my research group. Her enthusiasm and dedication, when one of the youngest members of the group is getting more done than the more senior members, everybody steps up their game. It's great if you're the advisor. So when she told me in the spring that her plans for the summer were to waitress to raise money for the next year at the U, I strongly encouraged her to instead apply for a chemistry department scholarship that would fund her through the summer to continue to do her research. So those funds coming from the donation of a happy alumnus from years ago, God bless. I had the pleasure of seeing her earn that scholarship. It was awarded to her, and she continued to grow as a researcher and further to integrate into my research group. And so I suggested to her that that fall she attend a meeting of the American Chemical Society in Chicago, and these are really fun meetings, chemists getting together, letting their hair down, and present a poster about her work. And this can be a very daunting experience for a young researcher, the first time that you're basically defending your own work in front of a lot of more senior people. And it turns out that there are academicians and chemists who can, in fact, be nasty individuals. But, you know, if you stand up for yourself, you have a chance. And Amanda took that on as another challenge, just like all the others, did a great job, came back happy, excited to have gotten better acquainted with sort of the professional side of chemistry. And so I'll cut this story short because I don't want to take up too much of your time. Immediately after her graduation, I kept in fairly close touch with Amanda as she applied for and worked in various entry-level jobs in the local industry. And after about a year, I got a call from a small biotech company in Eagan, and a staff scientist there asked me to provide a reference. And I was able to emphasize, as I spoke with him, that Amanda was not just a student whose qualifications consisted of a transcript marked with grades. Instead, she was this gifted researcher who could be counted upon to design and perform complex tasks, who'd already demonstrated outstanding independent ability. And so that combination of classroom learning and research learning really benefited her. And Amanda was hired. And so about a year after her hiring, she dropped by the U and she found me in my office. And the person who sat down across from me had so changed from the Amanda that I had first met. So here was a poised, accomplished, young professional woman. She'd made the jump from tired and struggling student to a self-confident scientist. She loved her job, too. And as we caught up, it occurred to me how much I love my job some days. That was just a wonderful moment to feel as though once had a chance to make a contribution to a student's life as they transition to the next phase of their life. But what I want to emphasize is that Amanda was one student. The U has many such students. There's a cadre of caring faculty, staff, administrators who dedicate themselves to every one of these young Minnesotans. More to the point, I honestly believe that if it weren't for the opportunity to participate in the research mission of the U, and so that's a unique and possibly publicly underappreciated feature of our educational mission, Amanda would not be where she is today. So coursework wasn't her passion, but research was, and for her, that made all the difference. And while I've told you a story from my history, and hence it revolves around a physical science, chemistry, I know my faculty colleagues in the arts, humanities, social sciences, business school, public affairs, education, across the entire breadth of the university, have equally inspirational stories to tell about guiding students not merely through the existing content of their field at that time, but the process of expanding human understanding of their field and growing the knowledge base. And some of those stories President Kaler mentioned as well. So I hope that you will do all you can to ensure that the state supports opportunities for future students to continue to be offered the same chance as Amanda. The chance to pursue her passions and become an accomplished scholar and citizen. In tough economic times, everyone at the U understands the state's got difficult fiscal choices. We all hope that the U will be recognized as a key contributor to solving those fiscal challenges. So thank you for letting me share Amanda's story with you. It turns out I'm always available to answer questions because that's part of my job.
Thank you very much. Members have questions of Mr. Kramer or Katie?
Question of the president.
And we'll get back to the president. Okay, thank you both. It appears as though you're clear to go, so, but the president has to stay. Okay. Representative Plowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, I'm looking at a document dated February 22nd, 2011. It's version 6 of the confidential draft of comments by President Brunix that were presented to this committee and other committees in the legislature. I'm just going to read part of the first page of page 4. For several years now, we have warned of a future tipping point. I believe you used the phrase tipping point in your presentation today, in which we would no longer be able to sustain deep cuts and remain the University of Minnesota that our state expects and deserves. That tipping point has arrived. With a 15 or 20% cut in state support, we are no longer talking about reducing or eliminating offices, centers, courses, and sections, cutting operational costs and degree programs, or consolidating colleges. Instead, we would be forced to re-examine the impact and financial viability of entire operations, statewide services, entire schools, colleges, and campuses, you name it. This is not a threat. It is a matter of scale. A cut in state support of 15% to $100 million, or a deeper cut, and then he lists four bullet points to that. And in your PowerPoint, makes some references to that. And then today, you alluded that the tipping point, has the tipping point, are we there, and can we actually see in specificity what harm has been done to the University of Minnesota?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, we do have a couple of slides that I will walk you through. I do believe we are at a tipping point. And a tipping point, to be clear, is a point in time where continuing on the path we're on will cause us to be a different institution than we are now. A couple of Thank you. Lodge, we have shifted the responsibility for paying for a college education from the state of Minnesota to the students and their families. The impact of a 30% increase in tuition over the past 5 years saddles our students with an average debt of $26,000. That's an amount of money that in a difficult job market can dissuade a student from pursuing the higher education that that person needs for a successful career. We have taken heavy burdens within our own faculty and staff. We have had three rounds of forced retirements. We've shifted health costs substantially to employees. We have furloughed and taken pay cuts from university employees, freezes for many employees, and cuts for administrators. In terms of specific academic issues, you see here across the range of colleges, and these are really examples, not not the total cut. College of Veterinary Medicine, a unit essential to the health of a key part of Minnesota's economy, over 100 positions cut. 60 faculty positions open in the College of Liberal Arts, positions cut in the library and CFANS and College of Science and Engineering. And importantly, we have asked our employees and their families and our faculty and their families to do more with less. We have stretched that rubber band. And a tipping point for a rubber band is when you stretch it another inch and it breaks. And I do believe that our university is at its breaking point. We have stretched not because it was the right thing to do for our students, but because it's the right thing to do for the institution. My colleagues, 25,000 of them, have taken on heavy burdens in times of financial difficulty to maintain the reputation and the excellence of the University of Minnesota. We have built this institution for 160 years. It's older than the state of Minnesota, and its reputation could be destroyed in a matter of years if we were to decide that our scope and scale would be defined by the state appropriation and that we scale back in reduction. We've stretched to maintain excellence and we've stretched to maintain who we are, but I don't think we can stretch anymore.
Representative Pawlowski.
Chair, President Kaler, I'm looking at the slide. I see the banner underneath strategic vision. I don't see the slide in my packet. Why weren't these slides included in your presentation today?
We have a variety of what we call backup slides, which are relevant to a variety of questions. We can certainly provide them to you and to the committee if you would like to see them.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pawlowski.
I'm going to go back to this document, which was almost a year today presented, that the tipping point had arrived a year ago, and you're saying you're at the tipping point still. Can you tell me when we actually get there? I say this seriously. At some point, when presentations are made to committees of the House and Senate, given the dire fiscal problems we are in, who do I believe, and when do I believe it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pawlowski, what you're witnessing is an institution struggling under a heavy load to maintain its excellence and its impact. We are trying to prevent the tipping point from driving this university into mediocrity. And the resiliency of the staff and faculty in doing that, in my view, is remarkable. I believe we are in a time where the economy will turn, where the opportunity for investment will reassert itself so that we can maintain and grow beyond that. That is a statement of optimism and one that encourages continued endurance by faculty and staff who've had little to no wage improvement and heavier costs shifted to them. But at some point, that rubber band would break. I am reluctant, and I'm sure my predecessor was reluctant, to decide let's break the band today. I can't tell you that we will close the medical school tomorrow to save the magnitude of dollars that are needed. I would hate to be the person to bring you that message, but I am trying to tell the committee, to show the committee the value of reinvestment in where we are. I believe the magnitude of cuts you've seen here, the rise in tuition and increasing debt indicates an organization under tremendous stress.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, President Kaler, I'm not asking for the dissolution of the University of Minnesota, but I am asking that if there are harms, we have to know about it. And we have to know about it at a level of specificity where you're going to get this legislature and this state not to continue to do it. And if I'm looking at a document a year ago that was presented in this committee, I'm not going to read the bullet points. You alluded to one thing he listed there that could be done. And then I have a presentation a year later, and this isn't in the presentation, although I requested it prior to the presentation. And these are the largest cuts to higher education in the history of the state. Some argued it's the largest cut to an institution of your caliber in the country. Would it be simply truthful to present the totality of this? I'm not arguing that you don't do good things. I think you do fantastic things. But if you want to continue to do it, do you think, honestly, that if you don't tell us the truth, we will not cut you again? And I don't mean we in my vote. I think you have to be able to tell us, both sides, the good and the bad. And you have to be brutally. These are brutal times. I don't want that university hurt. But I don't think you can stop it by continually to do, and I would say this isn't totally PowerPoint fluff, but there are parts of it. Some of this has to be presented to us to say this is what you did. There are results. There are results from actions. Those results have to be presented to the people that caused them. And you weren't in charge at the time, but you are now. And some of this has to come out. Or which do I believe? I mean, at what point? A year from now, are we still at a tipping point? Can we cut another $100 million? And if so, what list would I get then?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pulaski, we can give you these lists. I decided not to spend my presentation time about a vision for what the university could do and the impact it would have on reviewing these. I did expect you to ask me this question, which was why we prepared these backups, and I will give them to you in great detail. I did in my testimony say that the disinvestment in the university has cost the state of Minnesota $1.8 billion a year in annual economic activity. That's a pretty big impact. And I will continue to provide you with these specifics, and I will encourage you to not make another $150 million reduction and a $1.8 billion consequence for the state of Minnesota.
Representative Pulaski.
Mr. Chair, President Kaler, with all due respect, I would encourage you to get these to every member of the legislature and to the state of Minnesota so they realize what happens when these budgets are passed behind closed doors, locked doors, with three people doing a $35.2 billion budget, historic cuts to higher ed. There are consequences. And I respectfully suggest you get this to the state of Minnesota so they understand what the consequences are.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, President Kaler. Maybe this is an add-on to Representative Pulaski. I'm not exactly sure, but I know in the past there was a closing of a facility in Waseca, the University of Minnesota in Waseca, a two-year college. Your predecessor, I believe, closed the General College. And I'm just wondering if, not that I'm expecting you to say this is what could happen, but I'm wondering, are there other major things such as that can be done to cut back or you know, or reevaluate to be able to? I guess I'm just curious about that if as a follow-up.
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, there are obviously things we could close and do to deal with another draconian cut. And for reasons I'm sure you appreciate, I will not detail the specifics for you here. We could do that. The impact of that cut multiplied by 10 or 15 is the impact on the state of Minnesota. I am close to believing a calculation that would say that our economic activity generates more Minnesota state income tax dollars than the state of Minnesota allocates to its university. I'm not quite there yet, but it is a huge, huge impact. For us to close a critically important unit at the university, would be a terrible decision for the state of Minnesota.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a totally different vein, I'd like to talk a little bit about students. I had a couple of questions about the orientation process that students are now going through. And in my career, I have worked in higher ed, and one of the things we've previously talked about is recruit, enroll, retain, and place as a kind of a series of, you know, getting students in the door, get them educated, and get them out the door and into the job market, into their careers. And I'm wondering about the orientation process, and then sort of as a follow-up, I just like to talk about transfer students. And I know that the University of Minnesota is now accepting fewer transfer students, and I wanted to just get some information about that as well.
President Kaler.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy. An essential measure of a university's quality and its deliverability for its undergraduate student population, in my view, is the rate at which students graduate on time in 4 years, or what the federal government uses at a time and a half or six-year graduation rate. We showed you a slide earlier that shows our four-year graduation rates climbing. They're at 54% now. Our target is 60%. That's a tremendously good rate for a public institution like we are. I firmly believe that we should not admit a student that we can't ensure and help and guide to a successful graduation. A little bit of college is not all that helpful. We need to be able to bring students in and graduate them. So that graduation rate is very important to me. And that graduation rate is disaggregated into several discrete processes that we can influence. And we're influencing every single one of them, whether it's advisement, whether it's early counseling to get into the right majors so you don't wander around, whether it's class availability so you can take the courses in the sequence that you're after. And one of the most important steps is the first one, which is first to second year retention. Our first to second year retention rate is now a little bit over 90%, which is a very good number for a public research university. And an important part of that is getting the student oriented and engaged early on. And we now have a nearly week-long orientation process that is really best in class. We engage with students. We try to make a great big university small for them. We make them aware of a range of opportunities, and we strongly encourage their engagement in something besides classwork, because it's those connections, whether it's a club, a sport, a service learning, other activities outside the classroom that bring them together. Fraternity Greek life is an example. And those engagements are large. So I would stack our orientation program up against the best in the country, and the first to second year rate is a good way to measure that. In regards to your question about transfer students, indeed, we received some publicity out of scale with the magnitude of the adjustment of transfer students that we're making. To my earlier point that we should not admit a student who we don't project for success or that we don't think we can enable success, we looked at some data. And it turns out that for transfer students that we were admitting with fewer than 14 credits, so students who had completed only a semester or less, simply did not thrive. They did not move in a timely way towards graduation. And rather than admit those students who projected to not do well, we decided to reduce the number of students in that area. And again, we evaluate the applications individually and carefully. But as a group, we thought not taking those students to the university at that stage of their career, but asking that they complete another semester at a community college or otherwise, so that they would be better equipped to succeed at the university, was a smart, humane, and appropriate thing to do. There will be less than only a couple of hundred, the number escapes me now, 200 or so students at the most affected by these. The effect on Minnesota students will be very small. Most Minnesota students who transfer to us come from MinSCU, having completed a year, if not 2 years, and they will be fine. So the impact on Minnesota students is small. We think it's the right thing to do in terms of student outcomes.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank you for your presentation. It's impossible not to be impressed by both what goes on and the results. Your students really speak well of your endeavors and the quality of the programs. And this goes a little bit to Representative Pawlowski's, and I'm not trying to drill down in terms of those slides up there, but it does go to just a question that I have regarding, you know, the impact. And I know the dynamics of this is such that although we, you know, you didn't get $100 million plus more from us than you wanted, you made some of that up in tuition, and there were some cuts. I was looking at the employment slide, though, in terms of the impact there, and I did a quick math, and I think it is added up to about 324. Am I mistaken in that you have both full-time and part-time, and I'm not looking for an FTE number at all, but you have around 19,000 employees in your campuses?
President Kaler.
Yeah, Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, we have 20 to 25,000 employees.
Okay.
Those are headcounts. FTE is a number below.
Lower that. Yeah, okay. Thank you. So if I did some quick math, teach business, so I wasn't a math genius or anything, but I can add simple math anyway. That comes to about a reduction of about 1.5%. And I don't want to minimize that, because if you were one of those folks, 322, that lost your job, or maybe those positions weren't filled, it was still bad. But does that seem right about in terms of the total impact regarding employment as a result of the budget that we just passed?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, those would be reductions in FTE, and I sense your committee and the questions would indicate we should provide you a more comprehensive document detailing these cuts, and with the chair's permission, we would provide those numbers to you. There are other impacts also in what I would call foregone employment. We bring graduate students, researchers, other hires that we would make, and the nature of the university is that these are not long-term employees. They come, they have an impact, and they go, and so we haven't documented that magnitude of impact. I don't believe we include in that that number all of the cuts. Those are meant to be examples rather than total reductions, but we will provide that information to you.
I thank you for your time. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it was 2 or 3 years ago I attended a hearing called by then Chair Rukavina up in Mountain Iron regarding the lung disease among taconite workers and mesothelioma. There's some research going on now. Do you know where we're at on that? And maybe Representative Rukavina could fill us in on that, or the president. Where are we on the research now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Detmer, I do not have that information off the top of my head.
Okay.
I'm sorry to tell you. I can obviously provide it to you at a later date.
Representative Rukavina?
Well, Mr. Chair, we can get you exactly where they're at from Dr. Finnegan, who's leading that, I think. But my understanding is most of the science is done now, and they're pulling everything together. And they were waiting for some, community to see if there was people affected in the community and that. And there were some other dust studies that had to still be pulled together. But I think we'll see the results of that fairly quickly, but maybe President Kaler can get that information to you and I particularly.
Thank you.
We'll do that.
Representative Deputy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and President Kaler. Nice to see you, and thank you for the presentation. Early in the presentation, you mentioned that for every dollar we invest in the University of Minnesota, we get back $8. To the state of Minnesota in our economy. How did you come by that figure, and what's included in that $8, and how did you get that?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Epke, we have carried out an economic impact study. It's a fairly standard series of analyses prepared by a consulting firm. The actual return on investment is 13.5%. $2. It's $8.6 billion of activity divided into the state appropriation. That information is on our website, and we can provide you a copy. It includes, obviously, the jobs that we produce and then what are called induced jobs in the community that an employee base requires in the service industry, taxes paid, et cetera. So it's a standard methodology used around the country, and we can get you that report.
I would love that. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Sorry. Representative Poppy, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to wait my term again, if that was possible. Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Keeler, you talk a lot about being the state's only research university. Describe what that means exactly and in whatever terminology you'd like to use.
Sure.
President Kaler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy. A research university has as its mission the creation and dissemination of new knowledge. So when we have individuals involved in answering questions and defining new questions, that is the essence of research. So the contrast between our educational mission, which is often simply the dissemination of things that are already known to people who don't know them, you can contrast that with a research mission, which is finding out things that nobody knows. And we do that across a broad range of topics, from the liberal arts to medicine, engineering to agriculture. So it's really the creation and dissemination of new knowledge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Keeler. And I just wanted to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of your research centers, research institutes throughout the state, because the Hormel Institute is one of those, and you did talk about partnership with the Mayo Clinic and with others, but certainly there's research that's done throughout the state, not just in the Twin Cities area.
President Keeler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Poppy, indeed, our Duluth campus also has a substantial research component, as do faculty at all of our campuses. The balance between the expectations of faculty with respect to teaching compared to scholarship, research, and discovery varies across our campuses. But the primary mission focus of the University of Minnesota on research is part of our DNA, if you will. It is an important part of what we do. And those discoveries, those cures, those inventions have an enormous impact on the state of Minnesota.
President Kaler, we've talked a little bit earlier in the last few weeks about the invasive species that are affecting probably a large part of the state, but it really affecting the area that I come from, particularly the zebra mussels. And can you tell the committee if the university can play a part in trying to find a way to not only stop it, but to probably eliminate these little rascals?
Mr. Chair, indeed. Professor Sorensen has a proposal developed and under consideration in other committees to exactly do that, to tackle invasive species with focus on the zebra mussel and the Asian carp. And that is a terrific follow-on, if I could, to Representative Poppy's question. Why should you have a research university? You should have a research university because that's exactly the kind of institution that can bring to bear a diverse range of scientific and engineering expertise to solve that problem. For example, for the zebra mussel, what do you want to do? Well, you want it to go away. You can do that either by not letting there be any more baby zebra mussels by hormonal treatments. You can have physical or chemical barriers. You can have coatings and material that could kill the zebra mussels that you could apply and that is robust underwater. So you have the fields of biology. You have the fields of coatings. You have fields of species study that could come to bear on that particular problem. The Asian carp is another example. Again, chemical fields of coatings. You have fields of species study that could come to bear on that particular problem. The Asian carp is another example. Again, chemical or biological deterrence, prevention of reproduction, or physical barriers. And I was just at our St. Anthony Falls Laboratory recently where there is a study ongoing to use a bubble barrier, which prevents the Asian carp from coming across a river. And again, you layer all of that on top of the fact that the solution that we must find has to be economical and easy to use. And that defines a research problem, a multidisciplinary research problem that this university is uniquely able to tackle. And we have a proposal in front of the legislature to do just that.
Okay, well, thank you for that. Representative Deputy?
I'm going to echo the words of President Kaler. I was in a committee meeting in the environment because invasive species I've been working on for 3 years. I love Dr. Sorensen.
Great to hear.
And his presentation, if you ever have a chance to see it, it will just blow your mind. It's wonderful.
Members, I think that probably concludes our questions. I would just like to conclude by saying I appreciated your presentation, and considering what you've been dealt, I consider this to be a pretty positive report, and you're moving on. I think that's we're glad to see that with a positive attitude.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for having me.
Thank you for coming. With that, members, we're adjourned.